Welcome to today's CLUIN Internet Seminar on Evaluating Completion of Groundwater Restoration Remedial Actions. This is part of our NARPM Presents series, and this particular series is being sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Pete Riddle, and I will be moderating today's Internet Seminar with your two presenters, Kate Garuffi and Dave Bartenfelder. We'll get started here in a few minutes, and while we're waiting for some other folks to join us here in the meeting room, we're going to go through a few housekeeping items. So when you register for this particular Internet seminar, you were directed to a seminar homepage, which was the front page for the day's seminar. That gave you a short abstract, presenters, bio sketches. The one thing we do want to point out on that page is that the presenters' email addresses are included in case you have any questions that we're not able to address during today's live session. The screen you see up on right now is that seminar homepage there, and it shows you where some of those materials are, including the link to download the slides for today's presentation if you'd like to download them in either PowerPoint or PDF format. By default, the entire presentation will be, or the audio, I should say, for today's presentation will be delivered through the Adobe Connect meeting room. If you have any problems with the audio, either interruptions, skips, distortion, anything along those lines, we do have a conference call option available to you. Please just use that Q&A pod that's in the lower right-hand corner of your screen to privately submit a question to the moderators, and we will get you that call and information. If at all possible, I would suggest staying in the Connect meeting room for the visual portion, because we are going to have a screen share-based demo of the groundwater statistical tool during the second half of today's presentation. And obviously, it'll be beneficial if you're able to see that portion of the presentation, even if you are getting the audio over the phone. And just as a notification, we are recording this seminar. We will be placing this event in our archives on CLUIN. Usually takes us about a week to get that posted in the archives, and then you will receive an automatic email notification when this particular seminar has been added to the archives. This is just sort of a brief overview of what you're seeing in the Connect meeting room. I want to point out here that you can control the online audio.
Who's your jazz POC?
Here up with the screen button with the speaker icon. The Q&A portion, which is down here in the lower right, that you can use to privately submit questions to the seminar moderators, and then we'll address those during the Q&A portions of the presentation. Some related URLs that we'll go through at the end of the presentation, so that includes the seminar homepage with the presenter information that I mentioned before. We have some links to additional resources, including the statistical tool that we'll be demoing today, and a seminar feedback form, which we certainly encourage everybody to fill out at the end of the presentation. Something you may find helpful, especially during the screen sharing portion of the presentation, is we do have an option. This button, it looks a little bit different in the most latest version of Adobe Connect, but you can enlarge any particular portion of the presentation. Obviously, the slides as we're going through that portion of the presentation, and then when we get to the screen share demo, you can use that to take the demo full screen if it helps you see some of the detail within the demonstration.
Enough of this. Oh, well.
And let's see if there's anything else that we want to go through. If you do call into the phone line to get that portion for the audio, please go ahead and put us on hold. We want to make sure, or do not put us on hold, I should say, but please do put the phone on mute so that we don't get any background noise and things like that feeding onto the conference call and then into the meeting room. If you experience any technical difficulties that you're not able to address through the Q&A pod in the Connect meeting room, please feel free to give us a call at 301-589-5318. And with that, I will go ahead and kick things over to our presenters for today, Kate Garuffi and Dave Bartenfelder. They're going to start with a slide presentation and then move on to the software demonstration. Kate and Dave, I'll let you go ahead and get started.
Thanks, Pete. Is my audio okay?
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, perfect. All right, welcome everybody on the phone or in the meeting room. This is Kate Garuffi in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Myself and Dave Bartenfelder will be delivering the next two-hour presentation on evaluating completion of groundwater restoration remedial actions. Again, I'm going to reiterate to everyone on the phone, we're not globally muting you, but if you can please mute your phone so that we don't hear any background noise, I'm sure everybody would thoroughly appreciate it. Again, in the Q&A window, we're going to be having some question breaks. We encourage all questions to be sort of delivered through that Q&A window. Since there's 150 people on the webinar, opening the phone lines for questions would be a little chaotic. So we are going to encourage you to put questions in there throughout the delivery of the presentation. We're going to stop two or three times, address the questions in the box, and then continue. So our moderators are going to read the questions out when we stop. So if something, you know, you have a question about anything from right now till the first question series, feel free to put them in there and we will address them to the extent that we can. Again, we're doing a PowerPoint presentation and a demo of the statistical tool that we have issued in concert with the guidance documents that we're going to be talking about. I don't believe we have a reference to the actual web page, but I do recommend again that you go to the related URL section on the Adobe Connect screen. That will link you to our groundwater page that has the groundwater completion guidances as well as a series of other guidances on groundwater remedy selection, optimization, all other things here. Dave and I have given this presentation a lot generally to EPA project managers and management as well as technical resources. We're going to do our best to not speak in Superfund lingo and acronyms, so we're going to try to spell everything out. If by chance we start to get too acronym heavy for folks on the phone that are not, don't live Superfund day to day, feel free to shoot us a question. We can see the questions as we're talking, so if there's something that needs to be clarified in the short term, we're going to try to do that as well. All right. So just to introduce ourselves a little bit, I'll go first. Again, my name is Kate Garufi. I work in the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation in the Assessment and Remediation Division, and my focus is on construction and post-construction management. So for folks that are familiar with Superfund cleanups in the long-term remedial program, we work from signature of the decision document or record of decision through deletions of sites from the national priorities list. I was the author of the guidance document and the recommended tool that we are going to be talking about today. Dave?
And I'm Dave Barnfelder. I work in the same office and division with Kate. However, I'm in the science policy branch, and my responsibilities are mainly in the area of groundwater. A little bit broader than Kate's, I bridge not only post-rot also, but into the remedy selection area, mainly dealing with groundwater remedy selection, monitor natural attenuation, and technical impracticability.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Pete, before I get started, can you put the call-in number and the conference code in the Q&A section in case people are having trouble hearing through the Adobe Connect?
I certainly can.
Cool. Thanks. All right, so the objectives of the next 2 hours of our time together are for Dave and I to communicate and for you to understand EPA's recommendations for determining if a groundwater restoration remedial action is complete. We're hoping that we can provide recommendations for evaluating contaminant concern concentrations on a well-by-well basis in an aquifer, give you some exposure to the groundwater statistical tool and understand how it may be used in the context of evaluating well-specific data for determining completion or attainment of cleanup levels. And then finally, to provide some recommendations and to have you understand how monitoring well-specific conclusions for each contaminant concern may be used in conjunction with conceptual site model and other site characteristics to determine if a restoration remedial action is complete. All right. So as I alluded to before, in the course outline, the first, I would say, 15 slides, we're going to be talking about the November 2013 guidance for evaluating completion of groundwater restoration remedial actions. That guidance really outlines the framework for what EPA expects for determining completion of groundwater restoration remedial actions. And then after that, we're going to break for questions, and then we are going to do an overview of the recommended approach for well-specific analyses to support the November 2013 guidance, as well as a demo of the statistical tool. The recommended approach and the groundwater statistical tool are pretty much work well with one another. The recommended approach was written to support the statistical tool, and the tool, vice versa, was developed to support the recommended approach. So we're really going to work between PowerPoint slides, discussing the recommended approach, and demoing it with a synthetic data set for the tool to really hammer home exactly what we mean in the guidance and the recommended approach. For folks on the phone, one of the things that I want to reiterate or to clarify in order to just sort of tailor your questions to what's relevant to this webinar is in the Superfund program, we have a lot of groundwater guidance and policy and guidance expectations for the selection of groundwater objectives, determining cleanup levels, selecting remedies, implementing remedies, and then determining if they're complete. This webinar is going to assume that the remedial action selected chose groundwater restoration and beneficial use as an objective and selected groundwater cleanup levels that comport with EPA policy and guidance. So we're not going to get into remedy selection, applicable, relevant, and appropriate, or ARRs, determining cleanup levels, all of that. We are going to already assume that that was done and that we have selected a remedy that is compliant with CERCLA, which is our overarching rule, and the National Contingency Plan, which is our governing guidance and all EPA policy and guidance in that arena. And we are just looking at trying to determine at the end of the day if the restoration remedial action selected in the remedy decision document is in fact complete. So hopefully that clarifies. All right, so we are going to jump right into it and talk about the November 2013 groundwater completion guidance for short. So the purpose of this guidance is twofold. Number one, it was to provide guidance for EPA regions as well as other stakeholders, states, federal agencies, our responsible parties on how to determine when a groundwater restoration remedial action is complete. Secondly, it was to provide the EPA Superfund program and, as I said before, other stakeholders a Office of Superfund Remediation, or Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, which is our, is the office which we work in, a document that was written by our office specific to Superfund that clarifies groundwater attainment expectations that are referenced or discussed in a number of existing OSWR or EPA-wide guidance. We've been running into issues, I'd say, in the last 5 to 10 years of the program as sites are progressing through the remedial pipeline and getting towards completion or deletion from the MPL. There's a lot of really great guidances, both policy as well as statistical tools that are written by sister offices of ours, Office of Research and Development, Office of Policy, what's OPP?
It's just Office of Policy now.
Yeah, Office of Policy, as well as our RCRA office. There were a lot of guidances out there, but we really didn't have anything that was written specifically for Superfund and what we were looking for when we were trying to determine that restoration was done at the end of the day. So the product was what we are discussing today. So just to sort of reiterate that the only existing attainment guidance that really talked about Superfund and really outlined an approach for sort of determining that you're done was the Methods for Monitoring of Pumpetry Performance. It was June 1994 document written by EPA's Office of Research and Development. The picture that you see in this PowerPoint is taken directly from that guidance and outlined what we're going to refer to as the 6 steps for determining if a groundwater restoration remedial action is complete. We used this framework to write our guidance since the fundamental principles in this framework do not change. The issue that we ran into with this document is a couple things. Number one, the chapter on attainment was sort of hidden in a groundwater pump and treat guidance, methods for monitoring pump and treat performance. As folks know, and as the Superfund program has progressed, we've moved from choosing pump and treat to restore aquifers to moving towards a lot of more aggressive, passive, and active remediation technologies, such as Dave alluded to before, monitored natural attenuation, bioremediation, in-situ chemical oxidation, permeable reactive barriers, heat, as well as pump and treat. Because we're looking at active and passive technologies, this chart really pertains mostly to active remedies. And as such, we really wanted to be able to provide something more streamlined and flexible to take into account the fact that sometimes we're not actively treating or augmenting the aquifer when restoring it. Secondly, this pictorial does not really take into account the long-term groundwater cleanup process and the fact that interim decisions can be made throughout the process on determining on a well-by-well basis that you may have, in fact, met cleanup levels. So we wanted to write something that resonated more with the diversity of technologies, and number two, to really be able to talk about the role of well-specific conclusions in conjunction with other site factors as looking at plume remediation or cleanup of the aquifer as a whole. So this is our good starting point. As we move through the guidance, you'll sort of see that some of our pictures might look pretty similar. We just sort of call, we go from six steps to really talking about two. All right. So as I alluded to before, the guidance, the November 2013 guidance, recommends evaluating contaminant of concern concentration levels on a well-by-well basis, and then recommends that regions should use monitoring well-specific conclusions to provide a technical and scientific basis supporting the agency's conclusion that groundwater has met and will continue to meet cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern in the future. It's a pretty big loaded statement. So really, what the guidance focuses on, about 75% of the guidance, talks about how to look at groundwater in a specific well and look at the cleanup levels and contaminants of concern in your record of decision, and what types of questions one should be able to answer with the data in order to provide technical and scientific basis that the groundwater in that specific well meets the cleanup levels. We're going to talk about well-by-well analysis on the next couple of slides. We don't, in this guidance, explicitly state all wells must meet all cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern. It's not black and white like that. What we talk about here is the well-by-well specific conclusions should be the cornerstone for determining that a groundwater remedial action is complete and has met the cleanup levels in the record of decision. However, we do recommend, as always, that well-specific conclusions be evaluated in conjunction with other site conditions, such as a look at an up-to-date conceptual site model, any other outside influences, any source control activities to make an educated decision that's defensible. So we're going to get into that a little bit further. I'm sure there will be some questions that we get related to that. Okay. So a well-by-well analysis, what's the point? You know, groundwater plumes can be small or they can be very large. Your monitoring well network can have 5 wells or it can have 200 wells. So why do we, EPA Superfund program, really focus on a well-by-well analysis? Well, when we started the program in the early 80s, it was anticipated that groundwater cleanup would be a lot, I would say, faster or more straightforward and streamlined than it actually is. For folks that have been working in the groundwater arena since the Superfund program has been in place, or even before then, groundwater restoration is not a short term, and in many situations is not a very straightforward process. Groundwater restoration is contingent on understanding your hydrogeologic conceptual site model, understanding site subsurface characteristics, understanding and ensuring that you have adequate source treatment or source control. All those elements play into groundwater restoration, both the feasibility of doing so and the timeline for which it can be done. So, as many folks know, if you start with your remedial investigation, your feasibility study, and you select a remedy, a lot of times there's a lot of different things and information that will that will rear its ugly head during design, construction, and implementation of a remedy that will change site conditions. You know, so we're making a lot of changes. What always is constant in groundwater cleanup is the monitoring well network that should be adequately designed to characterize and evaluate the contaminated aquifer. The monitoring well network, as I alluded to before, is dynamic. The number of wells, where the wells are screened, the frequency of monitoring changes as information at a site changes or the remedy progresses. So as I said before, at the end of the day, if you have a plume that has 200 monitoring wells, obviously those wells have been used throughout the process, through the investigation, through the design, construction, and implementation of the remedy. If we were going to wait to make a groundwater restoration completion decision on data collected from all of those wells at once, it would be a costly, burdensome, and probably very complicated endeavor. So what this document talks about is that the monitoring well and making conclusions that a monitoring well has reached a cleanup level should be made throughout the lifetime of the remedial action. Once the remedy is put in place, a lot of times when we put technologies in place, we can see a good deal of plume reduction in the first couple of years of implementation of that remedy. So instead of waiting to make conclusions on wells that are at the far edge of the plume, we could make those conclusions early on and be able to streamline and have a more cost-effective and appropriate monitoring well network. And we're going to go into a very elementary pictorial to sort of explain that here in the next slide. So what this slide sort of shows is what I talked about in the last slide, and as I said before, in a very straightforward way. So what we're looking at in time zero here is the multiple colors or rings show probably different concentration trends for a plume. As you can see there, we've got a number of wells. The wells that are within the colors, I'll call remediation monitoring wells. So those wells obviously have contaminant of concern concentrations above the cleanup level. They're probably screened and monitored at a frequency to evaluate progress of the remedial action. The wells that are in the white indicate wells that are outside of the plume. Those wells are probably being monitored on their own frequency to what I would say call evaluating compliance or ensuring that the plume is not expanding and that our assumptions or conceptual site model remains appropriate. So this might be at time zero or when you selected a remedy. Obviously, at time 100, we've been implementing the remedy for some period of time, and hopefully, fingers crossed, we've seen some reduction in contaminant concentrations, the numbers, as well as the footprint of the plume. So as you can see here, there's a number of wells from time zero that were within the contaminant plume that are now outside of the contaminant plume. Since you've seen some progress here, you may decide to take those outer ring of remediation wells that were once in the plume and make determinations that the cleanup level had been met in those wells, therefore being able to modify the frequency of sampling to streamline your sampling and really focus your remediation phase, you know, your remediation monitoring or sampling of plume progress on the wells that are within the plume, and just maybe monitoring those wells once every 5 years to support a five-year review or just to ensure that the plume footprint is consistent with what you're seeing in your current conceptual site model. So again, you know, EPA, our responsible parties, the states, are implementing a host of groundwater restoration remedies throughout the country. This promotes decision-making throughout the process, allows us to leverage our resources, streamline our monitoring to really focus it on decisions that are necessary for determining completion, you know, streamlining the well network, the number of wells that we're monitoring, et cetera. All right. So the well-by-well analysis, this is sort of the heart of the guidance document. As I said before, this is the cornerstone of determining that a groundwater restoration is complete. For purposes of all stakeholders understanding what EPA expects, we talk about a well-by-well analysis in two phases. The first phase we're calling the remediation monitoring phase. The second is the attainment monitoring phase, and we're going to talk about definition of those two in the next couple slides. All right. Remediation monitoring phase. This is the phase of the remedy when you're looking at monitoring well data and the remedies being implemented and cleanup contaminant of concern concentrations are probably exceeding the cleanup level. So the remediation monitoring phase goes from implementation of the remedy to determining that the cleanup level has initially been reached. So as it says in this first bullet, during the remediation monitoring phase, you're either going to have active or passive remedial technologies being implemented to reach a groundwater cleanup level. You may have some active pump and treat. You may be doing some injections. You may have a permeable reactive barrier. Likewise, you may also have something more passive, such as monitored natural attenuation. So the completion of this phase provides all stakeholders a decision point for determining that the groundwater in the well has reached cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern. There's going to be a little nuance that we're going to talk about when we talk about the recommended approach, but I'm going to reiterate it, I'm going to introduce it a little bit here. With groundwater cleanup, for folks know, there's generally not one or two contaminants that we're addressing in a contaminated aquifer. It's generally a host of contaminants. And contaminant characteristics sort of dictate the persistence in the environment. Some contaminants are easier to clean up than others. So you're always going to see attainment or reaching cleanup level relatively quickly for those easier contaminants to clean up. And we'll generally see that the concentrations that linger above the cleanup level are going to be those contaminants that tend to be more persistent. So with the remediation monitoring phase in a well, we generally don't determine that this phase is complete until all the cleanup levels for every contaminant of concern outlined in your decision document has been met. And that's important to sort of clarify here, because attainment's done on a contaminant-specific basis. Remediation monitoring is just done for all the contaminants in the well. So the whole point for the remediation monitoring phase, or determining completion, is for all stakeholders to understand that you're transitioning from monitoring for remediation purposes to looking at attainment, which we will call monitoring of the aquifer during post-remediation type conditions. Remediation monitoring phase completion, or when you've initially reached your cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern, may also be an excellent point for EPA and other stakeholders to determine whether or not it's appropriate at that time to turn off any active technology. And with attainment, we'll talk a little bit about why that's important. So I'm going to move forward. We don't have any pictures. I'm sidebarring here, but we don't have any pictures, graphs for sort of showing you guys this during the discussion of the guidance, but we're going to show some pictorials to sort of hammer this home when we talk about the recommended approach and statistical tool. So if anyone's a little confused, hang tight. Hopefully we could clarify it when we get to that point. Okay, so attainment monitoring phase is the next phase. For folks that have been involved in groundwater cleanup, groundwater is a dynamic media. Therefore, EPA and other stakeholders, other federal agencies, universities, all the smart people in the room will tell you that you cannot say that a groundwater remedial action is complete after one or two samples have reached a cleanup level. That's because monitoring wells are generally distanced a certain amount of distance between one another, and groundwater flows at a certain velocity through the monitoring well. Therefore, we need to be able to provide an adequate amount of information to show that the aquifer has indeed met a cleanup level and will continue to meet the cleanup level. And that's what we call attainment. So attainment monitoring really happens after your data shows that you have initially reached a cleanup level, and that is to provide assurance that, number one, the contaminant cleanup level has been met, and number two, we anticipate that the groundwater will continue to meet the cleanup level in the future. One of the things that I wanted to talk about that Dave's going to speak a little bit more about when we go over the statistical tool is considerations of active versus passive systems in attainment. As I said before, if you have an active system cleaning up an aquifer, say pump and treat, and you've initially met a cleanup level in a well, and you're doing active pumping, the groundwater flow in the well and the characteristics that you're monitoring in that well are being augmented or impacted by the active technology that you have going on in the vicinity of that well. When you have a phase of monitoring that happens post-remediation, it allows you to turn the system off and to evaluate the aquifer in what we call post-remediation conditions. In attainment, it also allows you, if you're going to turn a system off, to evaluate whether or not you're going to have any rebound. If you've got matrix diffusion, some source that's not adequately addressed. The attainment monitoring phase also allows you to look at groundwater data to make sure that you don't have any what we call rebound. As I alluded to before, unlike the remediation monitoring phase, the attainment monitoring phase looks at every contaminant of concern individually and requires that you evaluate the completion of the phase, these two bullets at the bottom of the slide, for each contaminant of concern. All right. So remedial action completion, remedial actions obviously are for the entire plume that we're addressing. As I said before and throughout the presentation thus far, the remedial action completion determination is based and on the well-specific conclusions for each contaminant of concern. One of the situations that we've run into here at EPA headquarters for Superfund is that we've had an inconsistent application of statistics on groundwater data. We've run into issues where we've had people aggregating conclusions from wells, between wells, so if you have well one and well two, doing some sort of averaging between the two to make conclusions. Likewise, we've also seen situations where multiple screening intervals have been used in a well, and those results have been aggregated, which also does not represent the aquifer and showing restoration throughout the plume. So one of the things that this guidance does is it recommends that you do not aggregate either between wells or between intervals in a well. As I said before, this guidance recognizes that groundwater restoration is complex and every site is different, so it does not require that every well meet all cleanup levels, but it does require that you use the well-specific conclusions as a starting point and evaluate it in conjunction with the conceptual site model to, number one, ensure the well network was sufficient to characterize the lateral and vertical extent, and number two, to make a scientific and well-supported rationale or argument that the groundwater restoration remedial action is complete. Again, for I don't want to get too much into remedy decision, but the National Contingency Plan talks about EPA selecting restoration as an objective and when being done, showing that we have attained those objectives throughout the plume. So the way that EPA's guidance is talking about this is that we will use the well-by-well conclusions to start that discussion or be a point of departure for making that determination. So, as I said before, for EPA's guidance, it's documented. Remedial action completion for restoration is generally the last thing that happens at a site.
I missed most of it. I just got it.
Good reason too. I'm finished, but we have a meeting.
I just noticed. I forgot about that.
Now, can somebody put their phone on mute?
Important. Do you want me to stay for a while longer? I'm very sure of the changes I made relative to increasing.
Did you send them to me?
The number, you did. Yeah.
Excuse me.
And, yeah. Let's just talk through them. I'm hoping. Can we get this recorded later? I'm hoping. I don't know.
They do allow it. But I think you have to listen to the end to access the recorded.
Maybe. Okay.
They can give you.
Peter, are you on?
One.
Yeah. What is it called?
I can't remember.
Completion.
This is a good one for groundwater restoration and remedial action.
Excuse me. We can hear you. Whoever's having that sidebar.
Yeah. So I think this is a good one. I think they said last time you could get it, but then when I looked at the and I registered quickly, but the information they sent me didn't say you could access it later, but maybe we
can. Can you globally mute everybody?
I thought we did.
And you had to listen to what
they... Pete, can you globally mute everybody?
As I tell you, you can get it pre-recorded.
Pete's working on it.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So anyway, back to your...
I just want to make sure, well, you're going to, I mean...
So how did you highlight stuff? Oh, so you've got...
Open it up. Everything I changed was in red. I read once.
Did you change numbers?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I don't see any red numbers. Oh, there's one. Okay.
There's a lot of them.
Okay.
Is it star 6?
Star 6 is just going to mute yourself.
Regulators.
Okay. Sorry.
Right.
I apologize to everyone on the phone, but I'm not going to continue till.
Okay. Others, I increase lesser.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
All right, Kate. All right. I globally muted everybody.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Did you unmute yourself?
Yeah, I am muted. Can you hear me?
Gotcha. Yes.
Okay. All right, cool. So I had a breather from talking for 30 minutes. I apologize to everyone on the phone that was muted. Thankfully, I was pretty much at the end of talking about this document. So we can start with questions on the guidance that I just talked about.
Right. Okay, Kate, do you just want me to read the questions that you have? I mean, three people have sent in questions so far.
Yep. First, I encourage folks, now that I'm taking a break, to type in your questions. Again, we have the full 2 hours to answer them. So if you don't hit it now, we'll get it later. Let's go. Ready.
Okay. Sam Bass asks, how does the well-by-well throughout the life of the remedy approach work with sites that still have significant source mass remaining in the aquifer? Isn't there a risk that you may prematurely state cleanup is complete at a well?
Well, you can't determine at a well that it is the restoration remedial action is complete until you've met the cleanup levels that were selected in the record of decision. A lot of times when we have source control, we're generally restoring groundwater. If the source control is within the aquifer, we're generally restoring outside of that source control area. If the source control is not in the aquifer, or I guess like it's a landfill, then generally we're making those conclusions down gradient of that source area. I guess the way to answer this is, if once you make a well-specific conclusion that you've met your cleanup level, that does not mean that you abandon monitoring that well. If that well is being used in perpetuity, not only to demonstrate restoration, but also to verify that source containment is going to continue to be adequate, you may never stop monitoring that well. You may look at that well and be monitoring it for restoration, and once it's met its cleanup level, you may continue to monitor that well in perpetuity at a less frequent interval to evaluate if a containment remedy is working. So I would say, generally, we're going to go a little bit more into attainment monitoring. There's a good deal of information or data that one generally needs to answer the questions of whether a cleanup level, A, has been met, and B, you anticipate it, that it continues to be met. So I'm going to look to Dave to provide a little more detail.
Yeah, I'll add another thing that in getting at Sam's question, there could be two other options to consider. Mm-hmm. One is, if the material fluxing out of the source area is fluxing at such a low level that it's actually below the cleanup level, then it probably never really is a big issue and we'll always have low levels there. To me, the bigger issue is if by some chance we don't have a good conceptual site model and you have material still left in the source area fluxing out, but maybe fluxing out at a very low rate, so you prematurely say, based on your groundwater monitor wells, that we've got it cleaned up, but in fact what has happened is that the groundwater contaminant plume has not gotten to those wells, and that's an issue with you have to get back in looking at your conceptual site model to make sure you're not captured and you're caught in that kind of a situation.
All right.
Okay. we'll go on to the second question. And you are very popular. You have about 50 questions. So.
Oh.
Woo-hoo! All right. So we'll go for like 10. We'll go for 10 minutes, and then at the next break we can ask more. So.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So here's the second one. Are there considerations which would allow the establishment of the MWs essential for monitoring and conversely identify wells that are not required and available for abandonment without going through the formal process described in the guidance document? If so, what are they?
Okay, so are there considerations? Hold on, I'm rereading the question. That's an excellent question. That's actually the million-dollar question, I think. The question, Dave, is really referring to how do we determine what wells are essential for determining remediation as well as which ones are ancillary. So one of the things that we recommend is there's no guidance document that I think is ever going to be a policy document that's ever going to be written that tells you what monitoring wells are essential for making these determinations versus those that are not necessarily required. The idea is that hopefully throughout the lifetime of the remedial action, you've designed a network that adequately characterizes the different flow regimes and subsurface characteristics so that you can monitor fate and transport of the contaminants in the plume. Second, that as groundwater data is being collected and the groundwater remedy progresses, there are tools that EPA encourages throughout that process that are optimization tools to really make your monitoring well network as lean and mean as possible. So EPA has LTMO or long-term monitoring optimizations that we do that really looks at groundwater monitoring well networks in conjunction with the conceptual site model, looks at screening levels, looks at frequency, looks at where the wells are, and sometimes makes recommendations to say, you know, well A and B seem to sort of be evaluating or being monitored for the same purpose. They seem to be duplicative in effort. We recommend that you remove one of the wells from the network. That type of removal of a well may be appropriate, and you don't need to meet a cleanup level, for instance. But the idea is that the monitoring well network, through either long-term optimization or meeting the cleanup levels, you know, our anticipation here is that either you remove them because they're duplicative in nature or you meet the cleanup level. That's generally what we're looking at here. We're not, it's too hard since groundwater is so unique at every site and all the site characteristics are different. We can't really provide a policy document that recommends essential versus non-essential wells. I think that's really a site-specific decision. But again, if you remove wells from a monitoring well network that you determine to be not essential, then document that. Use it as your rationale when you're trying to complete the remedial action at the end of the day.
The only other thing that I would add is, and I agree with everything that Kate said, is depending on Ben, what you mean by formal, if formal equates to statistical test, that the policy does allow that if you do have a well that in your sequence of sampling events they are all below the cleanup level, then you don't have to go through the formal statistical approach. You can make the determination just based on the visual observation that, you know, the sequence of 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 wells are below the cleanup level and thereby meeting your criteria that way.
Okay, we'll go on to the third question. And the question is, what are your thoughts on using models to show that contaminants which remain on site in a couple of wells near the source will not migrate off site and will attenuate within X years to justify closure?
Okay, well, that's pretty simple, I guess. In Superfund, EPA selects restoration objectives and defines where those objectives apply. Generally, if an aquifer is a current or future drinking water aquifer, we select restoration objectives and associated cleanup levels to address the entire plume. So for purposes of determining that a restoration remedial action is complete, all the wells within that contaminated aquifer should show that you've met cleanup levels. So in a situation where you've, say you've cleaned up 90, and this is sort of the example, you've cleaned up, say, 95% of the plume, you got a couple pesky source area wells, you probably just have some lingering source material, you show that it's attenuating, you would need, for purposes of meeting the objectives in the rod, you would need to continue to monitor those wells until they show that the cleanup wells have been met. Not only the downgradient wells to continue to justify that there's no off-site migration, but in that source area, those monitoring wells, if it's restoration throughout the plume, you know, there's no TI, you need to meet your cleanup levels throughout.
Yeah, this question seems to be actually more directed towards M&A than I think directly to what we're doing here. You know, there is some overlap in that the tool can give you indications with regards to the trend, a decreasing trend, and that's probably one of the lines of evidence you need with regards to setting up an argument for M&A being applicable to, at the site. The other thing is the notion of just letting the plume migrate off-site, as Kay said, that's not something we hold to. You need to basically, you know, control the plume and, you know, have it stable to shrinking in size. But just to go ahead and let it migrate farther out, even though it's at a further decrease in concentration, is probably less than what we think is adequate for our remediation thrust.
Yeah, and I think also a lot of times we'll see a lot of pump and treat systems that have addressed a good majority of the plume, and there's just a small footprint remaining. The pump and treat system, you know, based on site-specific conditions, one, the stakeholders can decide to turn the system off and transition to something more passive, and that's you know, that can be supported by site-specific information, but at the end of the day, you're not done for remedial action completion purposes until all wells have met the cleanup levels, regardless if you transition from active to passive. So I think that's a good point of clarification. Next question.
The next question. Okay, how do you decide if you have both active pump and treat with M&A for other constituents determine ending remediation monitoring?
Okay, if you have pump and treat and M&A, the treatment is really irrelevant to the determination of remediation monitoring phase completion. If you're collecting data in a well, once that well has reached all cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern, the remediation monitoring phase is hypothetically completed. Then you would make considerations on whether or not you needed to discontinue active pumping. And then during attainment, that period of time, you would evaluate how the aquifer responded to modifications in the active treatment to make sure that you continue to meet them. So the technology doesn't really matter. What goes into the decision is still the same, and what you need to support that decision is irrelevant of the technology.
Okay. Can you talk about applicability of the guidance to RCRA corrective action or corrective action under a RCRA permit?
I think there is application. One of the things that was weighed heavily into the development of us developing this strategy was the RCRA Unified Guidance that came out in 2009. Now, that guidance touches on a lot of things, mainly in RCRA, and what we did is we pulled the tools and the modeling and the applications into what was specifically applicable to what we do in the Superfund cleanup. And there are basically a lot of similar thoughts with regards to Superfund cleanup monitoring and RCRA corrective action monitoring. And that's the latter part, not for like detection monitoring, but we would do something very similar to the RCRA program in their corrective action monitoring program.
Okay. Can the GW completion be captured in a monitoring report or a five-year review or in some already planned document?
All right. Easy question. So generally, if I would recommend that the progress, so an O&M report should capture well-specific conclusions. So if you've made a conclusion that a couple of wells have met cleanup levels or have finished the attainment phase, the remediation monitoring phase, that's a great place to put it because you're going to be doing those and putting them in the site record throughout the process. The five-year review is very good for evaluating where you're at in in terms of progress, so whether or not you're close to meeting cleanup levels, what are your trends looking like, what's the plume looking like in general. The place where you really want to document remedial action completion is in the final closeout report, which is an EPA document that begins the Superfund site deletion process. So I recommend the final closeout report because groundwater is generally the peskiest of all the media that we're going to be cleaning up. So at the end of the day in the remedial Superfund process, the final closeout report is the final document. That's a really great place to document it. If for some reason you've restored your groundwater before you've cleaned up something else, like, I don't know, sediments or something, then maybe you might want to make a clear determination in a chapter of your O&M report, just so that at the end of the day when we're going to delete the site, you can pull it out and put it into that type of documentation. All right, let's keep going.
Okay, does the guidance speak about aggregation of data at a single well across seasonal variations?
No, the guidance doesn't speak directly to that, but that's something you need to consider, and as you're laying out your data to see if there are seasonal variations in the data, if you can notice it just visually, you should try and account for it. The tool itself does not account for that. The other thing is probably if you're noticing seasonal variations, it will have a direct impact with regard to what your slope is, your trend analysis, and also your 95 UCL. But we don't aggregate any data as of right now.
Next question. Will you elaborate on how the appropriate duration of attainment monitoring is determined?
We will in the upcoming slides. So just a point of departure for any of the questions that are coming in. The guidance that we just went over is a broad overview of remediation phase and attainment phase at a particular well. The recommended approach is going to talk about data considerations, frequency of monitoring, number of sampling events, how to deal with outliers, how to deal with non-detects, how to determine, or I already said frequency, and then statistical recommendations of statistical tools one may use when evaluating data for purposes of remediation phase completion as well as attainment completion for each contaminant of concern. So any of those questions, hold your horses. You will see it soon. Okay, next.
Let's see. Does this guidance conflict with Triad, or does Triad not apply to Superfund?
Well, our technology innovation group wrote the Triad guidance, so I would say it applies to Superfund. I can't really answer that question without the specific piece of Triad that you're referring to. Triad's really sort of applying the scientific method to cleaning up the site, the way that I look at it. If it's related to real-time data tools, I don't know what the question is, so I'm going to defer.
Okay.
So they can clarify.
Okay. Here's the next one. Is there a specific percentage of wells you are suggesting when you say not every well needs to meet all cleanup levels? Understanding the assessment is site-specific and sometimes has to be based on professional judgment.
We cannot give you a specific percentage. I guess the way that I can clarify it, I guess the way that I could make it clear is we generally expect all wells to meet cleanup levels, but we're open to some argument to the contrary given site-specific situations. But if 95% of your wells have met cleanup levels, that's not adequate. We're looking at we're talking about perhaps monitoring wells where you have certain anomalies or there's well structural issues or, you're seeing sporadic exceedances in wells that are not hydraulically connected, thereby saying you don't have a plume. So I can't really give you a black and white description, but we provided the flexibility in the situation that site-specific situation sort of lends itself to making that conclusion. But I would just say when you're moving forward, think all wells. That's a good place to start.
Okay, you've been answering questions for about 12 minutes.
Okay. I'm going to take a peek at some of these other ones real quick. Okay. All right. Well, if I did not answer your question and you want to ask it again, I apologize if I have not answered your question, or Dave or I have not answered your question. Type it in, copy and paste, and type it in again, and we'll try to hit it again on the next question break. All right. So we're going to move on. Dave and I are going to tag team this next section, and we're going to do some demo. Moderators, I will let you guys know when I need you to split the screen, but not yet.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So in August of 2014, EPA issued a memorandum that finalized two things, a document and a statistical tool. The first one was the recommended approach for evaluating completion of a restoration at a groundwater monitoring well, and the second was the groundwater statistics tool. As I stated in the beginning of the presentation, the recommended approach for short and the tool comport with one another. One of the things that I want to state, and it's very clear in the first couple paragraphs of the recommended approach, is the recommended approach and the statistical tool are just that, recommended. We at EPA recognize that there are a lot of groundwater tools or statistical tools that are available for evaluating groundwater data. There's ProUCL, Meros, just two right off the top of our head. We wanted to develop a recommended approach for structurally, you know, sort of outlining what we expect you to look at in a well and some considerations when looking at your data sets, some recommended statistics, and then provide a tool. And this tool is available on our website. It's public. But it provides our EPA Superfund community with an easy tool that can be accessible by any of our staff and can be data can be input and it can be manipulated to evaluate where you're at in the process, whether you think your remediation monitoring phase is complete, whether your attainment phase is completed a well. It can also be used to evaluate conclusions that come in from parties other than EPA that are documenting or doing groundwater monitoring, states, tribes, responsible parties, other federal agencies. So it's really just a tool that we are providing as a resource for our community at EPA as well as other stakeholders to provide some robust statistics to look at some data. We're going to go a lot more into the statistics and the nitty-gritty of it with Dave as he goes through the tool, but what we're going to do right now is sort of outline it. So in the recommended approach, as I just sort of stated here, and I'm going to go over the slide, it provides a methodology for conducting analyses at a specific well, so one well. It doesn't talk about how to make conclusions for, based on multiple wells for the entire plume. It's just looking at the groundwater data collected from one specific well. The document contains recommendations on data set considerations, as I alluded to before, how to handle outliers, what are outliers, how to handle non-detect from certain sampling technologies, talks about frequency and how to determine what frequency is appropriate. It talks about recommendations for numbers of samples that should be used for the analysis of remediation monitoring phase completion, likewise the number of samples that we recommend for attainment. It also talks about, in the event that data lends itself to a statistical evaluation, it talks about some statistics that we recommend in remediation monitoring phase, as well as some statistics that we recommend in attainment. So as I said before, the statistical tool comports with the recommended approach. It uses statistics to evaluate completion of a groundwater remediation action in a specific well for a specific contaminant. So if you're using the statistical tool for remediation phase completion, you would probably look at all of your contaminants and use, you know, plug your contaminant specific information in for your data for each specific contaminant to make a conclusion at the well for all of them to complete remediation. And then for attainment, since it's done on each, for each contaminant, you would use the data, the tool separately for each contaminant. Although the groundwater statistics tool was made for groundwater restoration remedial action completion, and we'll talk about the statistics that we recommend for that in later slides. Not to get too far ahead of myself here, but we do provide a robust ability to do trend analysis in this tool. So although it's used for remedial action completion, this tool could potentially be used by others to evaluate, do some trend analysis to really evaluate progress for purposes of data evaluation during the five-year review, for example. And maybe in some instances look at data trends for purpose of maybe to support a capture zone analysis or something along those lines. So the tool does, again, provide a lot of statistical options which could be used for a myriad of different things throughout the process. All right. So finally, here's a picture of groundwater in a specific well. For anyone that's familiar with the recommended approach, if you've looked at the PDF on the website, we talk about the, as I said before, the data set considerations, remediation phase, and attainment phase recommendations. And in order to sort of conceptualize that for the user, we have a synthetic data set that we run through an example throughout the document. So this picture is that data set. I know a lot of folks are looking at it and saying, oh my God, that data set looks so ideal. And the answer is yes, it is ideal, but we needed something to sort of demonstrate what the purpose and the point was for using that. And this data set, as I said before, is going to be used when Dave demos the statistical tool. You'll see this slide coming up a couple times. When this slide comes up, we're generally going to use a split screen so that Dave can speak a little bit to the slide and then use the statistical tool so you always have a reference. All right, so getting into what the recommended approach recommends. So remediation monitoring phase completion determination. As we stated in the guidance, the remediation phase is really the point during groundwater monitoring in a well where all stakeholders agree this well has reached all the cleanup level for all contaminants of concern. Let's look at attainment. It provides that decision, as well as in the event that the well that you're monitoring is being influenced by an active system, it may be a logical point to terminate the active system so that during attainment, you're not only evaluating groundwater for purposes of showing that the groundwater continues to meet the cleanup level over a period of time, but also allows you to evaluate data to ensure that you don't have any contributing sources into that well, for instance, some sort of rebound. So the methodologies that the recommended approach talks about are twofold. First, Dave's going to show in the slide that sometimes based on the behavior of the data, there's no need to do statistics to determine that the remediation phase is complete for a particular contaminant. You can look at the data and say, oh, everything's below, it's always been below. We're going to visually or non-statistically determine that the cleanup level has been reached. In most cases, particularly for those pesky, more persistent contaminants, we generally see data that tends to be a little bouncy around the cleanup level, or approaching the cleanup level gradually. In those instances, it may be appropriate to apply some sort of statistics to determine for that particular contaminant that it's initially reached the cleanup level, and there's going to be a mean test and a trend test, and I'm actually going to turn it over to Dave to begin first talking about the trend test, then the mean test, and do that while demoing the statistical tool. So can we split the screen? Hold on 1 second. I'm sharing. Give me a sec. All right. There you go.
All right. Thanks, Kate. This is Dave. We're now looking at the input, data input sheet for the statistical tool. You'll notice that to the left of that is an example data. We included with the tool, I think it was 12 example data sets that exercised the tool that you can see some of the different capabilities of the tool. In looking at the original figure that Kate put up there that had TCE, DCE, and vinyl chloride synthetic data set, we try to show a couple things here. The first off is you see the decline, the very steep decline in the TCE levels in a gradual asymptotic approach. You'll see a general gradual incline in the vinyl chloride that hovers around its MCL, and then you also notice the DCE line. We use CIS with the MCL of 70 parts per billion. And as you notice with the DCE, this is probably an example where you really don't need to do the statistical test to determine that you've met completion for DCE, because all the values are below the MCL throughout the life cycle, if you will, of the groundwater monitoring. So I'd like to go ahead and do two data sets, the first one being the TCE data set, and then I'll go ahead and bring up a second data set, which is the vinyl chloride. Now, with the tool, does have certain limitations, and we never envisioned that the tool would be able to answer everything for everyone because of time and budgetary limitations of putting the tool together. But we tried to put a tool together that would be appropriate and useful in many of the situations that we thought we would encounter. So with regards to doing the trend analysis and the UCL and the mean, the trend analysis can generally has two components. If the data set is linear, it'll do an ordinary least linear squares regression. If it's a nonlinear type situation, or if you have non-detects, it will go ahead and do a Mann-Kendall test and do a Thiel-Senn line. For the 95 UCL on the mean, we're looking at, for normal, a student's t-test. If there is non-detects, a Kaplan-Meier-Chebyshev, and also if it's non-parametric data, we're looking at the Kaplan-Meier-Chebyshev. We decided that we weren't going to include all the non-parametrics. It becomes a little bit too laborious and somewhat confusing, but the Chebyshev seemed to be a pretty robust and handled most situations that we thought would be appropriate and adequate, so we limited it to that. Also, we don't do transformations in this tool, so if you have that kind of a data set, it will probably be dealt with as a in a nonlinear or non-parametric way. So for the first thing, as you'll notice, is the tool itself, there are four data points that we use. And generally for the remediation phase, we have said that we're looking for a minimum of four data sets, mainly to have a good handle on the statistics, have reliable statistics, and also a good handle on the hydrologic subsurface conditions. Having less than four causes problems either way. We don't specify what those durations or frequencies should be, even though for here we just have it as months. It's just for the simple calculation. For the attainment phase, which we'll get to a little bit later, we're looking at, we recommend eight, but you can use something less, but no less than four. All right, for the remediation phase, as we have presented in front of us, we have the four data points, and you'll notice that even though we have data points from date 1, 2, 3, 4 all the way out, we actually wound up doing the analysis on data sets 5, 6, 7, and 8. And the question will probably at some point come out is, well, why did you go ahead and only pick those? And why not use the earlier ones? Well, for the remediation phase, to meet the remediation phase to trigger you in, you can either meet it by doing the, by meeting a 95 UCL on the mean less than the regulatory standard, or you can meet it by a trend analysis where the 95 confidence band along the mean goes below the regulatory standard. And that's really important, the idea with the 95 confidence band. Sometimes you might think you do it, but the 95 doesn't quite get you there. So as Kate mentioned earlier, there's a couple tests that we go ahead and do. One is to check for outliers. Another is to go ahead and check for non-detects, do the trend analysis, and then also the 95 UCL on the mean. Where I'm scrolling at right now is under the axis values. We manually have set them for 4 and 9. There is the auto function that is the default, like you see with the concentration. So originally that was set to auto, so it went from 0 to 9. And I had already gone ahead and changed that to make the figure just to look a little bit better and easier to understand. But you can make those modifications, and when you do, you just wind up hitting the reset concentration axis, and it changes the Y and the X axis as you set appropriate. So I'm going to go ahead and move through right now to the check for outliers. So it takes a little bit of time for the computer to think. But just also as we're thinking about this, on the data set, okay, we moved on, hold on. You can see that we stood at the rejection level of 1%, and our test statistics for both low and high, let me go back here for a second. Sorry about that. Just to see some things that were going on for adding your information, just some basic rudimentary information. When you get to this cell right here, you have the ability to determine whether you want attainment or the remediation analysis done. Scrolling down to this cell as you're inputting your data, we have another drop-down menu that you can set what your units are, whether it's a month, year, or the date, and the date can be, you know, on the lines of 11/12/2014, depending on how you'd like to see it and how you have it represented. You can set your concentrations, micrograms per liter, parts per billion, whatever it might be. The default we have is 95, but it does allow you to make a few little changes if you want to do 90 or 99%. And also the drop-down menu exists for looking at your outlier rejection rate, and we have it at this time set at 1%, but you can also change it with regards to that. All right.
Do you want to answer any questions while we fix it?
Just close it and we'll open it back up again.
Okay.
I apologize. Something has happened. I don't know. It's maybe something unique with regard to storing the share.
5-3.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go back to input screen. Okay. So we're back. Let's see if we can go ahead and get this thing moving forward. All right, so the first test it does is check for outliers. Takes a little time to see if there's anything within the data set that is statistically an outlier. If there is an outlier, you do have options, and we'll test this later, that you can identify outliers and either remove them and run the statistics for normality and trend in UCL, or you can leave them in. In this particular case, you can see that our test statistic for both high and low outliers is lower than our critical value, so we have not identified any outliers in this particular case, so we don't have to worry about that. So without having outliers, we're going to go ahead and move on to the next test to see what the normality is, if it's a normal or non-normal. A data screen has popped up here, which we will go ahead and decline. In looking at the data for the all data, and this is pertinent to the 95 UCL calculation. The data appears normal. So in that particular case, we will be go ahead and probably be using the student's TUCL. However, for the residuals, which is germane to the trend analysis, the data does not appear normal. So for the trend analysis, we will be using something else besides ordinary least squares. So I'm going to go ahead and click the button for going ahead and do the trend analysis. And to do the trend analysis, it's going to go ahead and take a second or two in using the Mann-Kendall test and the Thiel-Senn. It's going to use a bootstrap technique to get us to those results. So it's progressing through right now, and then we'll go ahead and give us an output here in just 1 second. While this thing is thinking, just let me go ahead and go back. You, as I mentioned earlier, that we use data points 5 through 8 for doing the analysis. And I hope to show here in just a second why we use 5 through 8, not 4 through 7. Because the reason that we have here is that, as we can show right now, the test result is that the normalized S is negative and greater than the critical value. So it's a decreasing, as shown also here. So you have a decreasing trend, which is what we're looking for, and that's one of the two criteria for getting into the remediation phase. So we've met the criteria for that. Now we'll also look at, could we possibly meet the criteria for the 95 UCL on the mean? And as we look at here, this gives us a basic output. We see the same trend analysis again. And the mean of our concentration for the data points is 3.75. However, our 95 UCL in the mean is 5.92. So as far as meeting the remediation criteria on 95 UCL in the mean, we have not met it in this particular case. Now, going back to the trend analysis, I had mentioned that we had met it, and we can go back and see it once again. And we had met it for using points 5 through 8. And if you can notice with the screen that we have the points coming down, the crossing over the regulatory line, cleanup level line in the red, and progressing down. And the 95 trend line is also crossing over. So the question is, well, why couldn't we just truncate it at this point, the 6th point, or maybe the 7th point? I'm not going to show it right now, but you can see for yourself that if we actually would have, instead of taking points 5, 6, 7, and 8, we would have taken 4, 5, 6, and 7, the situation that would have arose is that the 95 confidence trend line would have truncated and asymptoted above the 90, the cleanup line. So we would have not met the trend criteria in that particular case if we would have used 4, 5, 6, and 7 or 3, 4, 5, and 8, even though we would have had a pretty steep trend based on the data that we had at that particular point. So the take-home message here is that we have actually triggered ourselves into the remediation by meeting the trend test using the 5, 6, 7, and 8 data points. Oh, right, into attainment. We met the remediation goal.
Okay. So you want to do final four now?
Yes. Okay. So we met that one. The other thing, you know, the three that we were looking at was the case of vinyl chloride.
All right. Still have the picture of the chart on
it. Okay. So here again, you had 8 points for vinyl chloride. We actually started with 1 to 8, plugged them in, left the sequencing as auto for both. We wound up changing. The only thing we really changed was, of course, the cleanup level was 2 for vinyl chloride. I don't know why that keeps coming up.
Because you're clicking.
Oh, okay. All right. So we're going to go ahead and run the system again for the outliers for vinyl chloride. Take just a second for it to think through the process. Now remember, for the TCE, we met it for the trend, and we'll see how we do here for vinyl chloride. So for the trend and for the outlier analysis, we're using the Dixon's outlier test. Once again, we have no outliers for vinyl chloride, either high or low. So we're going to go ahead and progress with the data set as we have it. We get our UCL box. Calculations are okay. And with regard to the data, all data and the residuals for the trend, they both appear normal. So we'll be applying normal statistics for this particular data set. And what we see here is that we have an increasing trend, which is something that we're not too happy about. It's not something that would trigger us into remediation, allowing us to progress on to the attainment phase. So as far as it goes right now, we don't make it with regard to the trend test for the vinyl chloride data set. However, when we go ahead and we look at the UCL test, that we have a mean of 0.974 and a 95 UCL 1.45, which is below the MCL of 2. So we trigger ourselves once again with the data set up into the 8th data point for vinyl chloride using the UCL test, not the trend test. Now, the one thing that raises a red flag for us is that even though we've triggered ourselves into attainment, we still have this increasing trend. So it's something that we have to be very careful about to see where this progresses, because with situations, it could continue to increase later on, or it could drop back off again, and that would be fine. But as of right now, we have been able to trick ourselves in using the mean test for this particular case of vinyl chloride.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So can we unshare the screen or hide it? Okay. All right. So just in summary, as Dave just went over, when we talked about remediation phase, as you can see in the line here, that's vertical. Based on a visual examination of the DCE, which never exceeded the cleanup level of 70, a trend analysis of the TCE, and a 95% upper confidence limit on the mean for the vinyl chloride, it was determined after sample event 8 that all the contaminants had initially reached their cleanup level. So then the attainment phase begins. So, as we said before in the guidance, the November 2013 guidance, the attainment monitoring phase completion or the analysis of attainment monitoring phase is performed for each contaminant separately. Again, this is because contaminants behave differently in the subsurface, and as such, one needs to make a conclusion for each one to show that they have been met. We're really looking to answer two questions during attainment. The first one is to determine or provide assurance that the cleanup level for the contaminant of concern in the well has been met, which we use the upper 95% upper confidence limit on the mean. And we provide assurance that the groundwater in the well will remain below cleanup levels in the future. So really what we're doing is we're taking data collected in that well and trying to make a prediction into the future. So for that particular analysis, we recommend looking at the slope of the time-dependent trend line for the data collected during the attainment phase. So, as I said before, unlike remediation phase where you can do visual, trend, or mean, what we're looking at here is either visual or trend and mean. So instead of the possibility of one statistical test, We're looking for the need to evaluate two types of statistical tests. Again, the upper confidence limit on the mean as well as the slope on the trend. Because we're requiring two lines of evidence here, and we want some certainty we want some confidence in the data analysis and the statistics, the recommended approach recommends 8 data points be used for this analysis. When you look at the tool, I don't know if Dave mentioned this earlier, the tool can run with 4 data points at a minimum and can be run with up to
20.
So analysis of attainment can be made with less than 8 data points. However, it is recommended that you consider using 8 because of the confidence associated with that number of data points and the use of both of those statistics. So one of the things before we get into the data, we talked a little bit about attainment being monitoring to reflect post-remediation conditions. So there's really two scenarios when you're looking at attainment, starting to collect your attainment data set. The first, which would be the easiest, would be if you have a passive type of remediation ongoing at the time that you make start attainment. So say you're doing monitor natural attenuation. Obviously, you're using natural intrinsic bioremediation properties in the aquifer to remediate or destroy contaminants and to reduce concentrations. Therefore, there's no type of active system augmentation that's happening to the aquifer. So remediation and post-remediation conditions, in essence, are the same. Therefore, one would not anticipate seeing a great change during attainment that you would see for an active system. So you're probably not going to see any rebound because you're not doing any active type of treatment. So if you're doing some sort of passive remediation in the vicinity of that well when you determine that attainment monitoring can start, we do provide the flexibility and the recommendation that you look at your data sets, especially those data points that you collected at the end of the remediation phase. And if some of those data points perhaps are below the cleanup level, it might be appropriate to shift the attainment window over into the remediation phase a little bit and, you know, evaluate whether or not it makes sense from a site-specific perspective to include some of those data points. And again, the reason that we're recommending looking at the data and providing that flexibility is because the aquifer is not changing between remediation and post-remediation or attainment type conditions. There's nothing that's changing from groundwater pumping, chemical introduction, biological amendment introduction, et cetera. The other thing, and then conversely, if you have an active system, perhaps a pump and treat, and the monitoring well completes remediation phase but is being impacted hydraulically by a pump and treat type system or an extraction well, you're obviously going to want to try to, if possible, turn that well off to mimic post-remediation conditions during the attainment phase. In that situation, when you turn the pump and treat system off, sometimes you may see the data do what we'll call a blip or a temporary rebound, just as the aquifer is re-equilibrating or trying to find steady state. So sometimes in attainment, you may see a lot of data variability or noise right after the system's turned off. As such, you may have to collect more than the hypothetical 8 data points in order to shift the 8 data point analysis window to not include the data that's really noisy, just because it's going to throw your upper confidence limit on the mean a little higher than if you have a tighter data set. Again, if you see that temporary rebound, it may just be a result of the system re-equilibrating, or it may also be some sort of rebound associated with additional source or some sort of activity that may warrant the reintroduction of some sort of remedial technology. But it's not surprising to see that type of data impact in attainment at the beginning if you're changing, going from active and turning that off and having the aquifer rebound. So a lot of those things can sort of be considered. Dave's going to talk a little bit about that when we look at the data set for the attainment statistics. As I said before, the methodology here is twofold. Either you can look at the data, you'll see in the next slide for DCE, it's very clear since the cleanup level had never been exceeded that you could do a visual determination that A, the cleanup level has been met, and B, you anticipate it to be met in the future. If you cannot do it visually, you will generally, and you have data that's either above and below the cleanup level, you have detected data concentrations, you have a combination of detects and non-detects, you're probably just going to want to employ some sort of statistics. So Dave's going to run through the data tool for for vinyl chloride and TCE. We're going to keep the slide up here so you can talk a little bit about it, the rebound. So which one do you want to do first?
Let's do the TCE.
TCE.
Okay.
All right, can we share the screen again?
As Kate mentioned, that in the figure that we have that we've seen a couple of times already, the DCE once again has stayed below the MCL of 70 parts per billion from 0.9 to the end of its duration of sampling. So we, in that case, can just use a visual observation to say that we have still attained our cleanup level. And we are good with the DCE. And looking at the TCE and vinyl chloride, these don't quite follow. We see that they kind of ebb and flow above and below the MCLs. So it's probably best for us to go ahead and do the statistical test to see how they come out based on the data. So for the TCE, in the remediation phase, we triggered ourselves into attainment, if you will, monitoring after 0.8, because we said we were below the, we had met the remediation criteria for the TCE using the slope. So now we start looking at the data points post number 8 to see how they play in. So the changes that we've made, we went back into tool, and we changed this cell from remediation to attainment. It's about the only thing that we've done, and we changed the data points there. And I'd like to just quickly just go ahead. And I mentioned earlier with regards to the figure that they originally default to auto, and I had changed them for the other one, but I will go ahead and change them here. And we will see... and go through how the tool handles that. So I'm going to go ahead and reset the concentration axes. It'll take just a moment to go ahead and do that. And hopefully it'll be just an easier figure to go ahead and see instead of being one that's always smashed to the right. So it'll just take a second to go ahead and get that through. So we now have the new figure across the whole diagram. It's a little bit easier to see. So the next thing is we want to go ahead and check for, once again, based on the data set that we have, are there any outliers? So when Kate mentioned, you know, for the attainment phase, we're looking at a recommended 8 data point set to do our evaluation. So we looked at points 9 through 16. We're checking to see if there are any outliers in this particular data set using the Dixon test. And once again, we find that there are no outliers, either high or low, with this particular data set. And one thing that I failed to mention earlier on in our box and whisker plots is a nice feature in the tool that we have here. Instead of a box and whisker plot where all the data points are just lined up on a vertical axis, they've kind of been separated out so you can actually kind of see where they fit into the whole sequence. So if there is an outlier, you can kind of get a better idea of where it is. It's just easier to represent. So with no outliers, we're going to go ahead and check to see with regards to its normality. And for this data set of 8, for the 95 UCL and the mean, it appears to be normal, so we're going to use the student's T UCL. And for the residuals that is germane to the trend analysis, that also appears normal, so we're going to wind up using a linear regression. Okay, so what we have here is that our statistics show us that with regard to this data set, we have a statistically significant decreasing trend We can see it in the figure here. The 95 UCL confidence band crosses over the MCL cleanup line, which is now we've met one of our two criteria for saying that we have met attainment with the data set that we do have. So the next step is we have to see if the 95 UCL on the mean also meets that criteria. And in this particular case, we have a mean of 4.26. However, the 95 UCL on the mean calculated with students' TUCL is 5.8, so we're slightly above the MCL. So while we have met one of the two criteria, we did not meet the criteria for attainment using the 95 UCL on the mean. If you were to go ahead and add, we stopped at data point 16. If you were to add data point 17 or data point 18, you would come to find out that going from 9 to 17 or 10 to 17 or 9 to 18 or 11 to 18, that we at that point did meet our 95 UCL on the mean. When we use 9 to 17, our UCL is 4.86, and we use 9 to 18, we have a 95 UCL of 4.63. So we have met it using those. So basically what it says is, for the case of this example, when I truncated it at 16, that we did not meet it. So what we would need to do in that case is go out and take one or two and then check to see if we did meet it. And in this particular case, we did. You can go back to the original data set in the example and go ahead and run that through and see that we have met the two criteria for the 95 UCL on the mean and the trend with that expanded data set, and thereby saying that we were complete, at least for TCE, at that particular time. So having been through that, the other thing for us to do is to go back and to check for vinyl chloride. Once again, with vinyl chloride for the remediation phase analysis, we said it was 1 through 8. We met it through there using the criteria of the UCL, but we didn't meet it for the slope. As Kate mentioned earlier, that one of the things that we're concerned about is, you know, making sure that we have a true representation of what's going on in the subsurface environment. And if you think about the first figure that Kate had put up from the 1994 ORD document, in between meeting it for the first time and doing attainment, there was a steady state phase that had to be achieved. So if you have a situation where you're doing active remediation, perturbing the subsurface environment by pumping or the addition of a chemical like ISCO or, you know, something like that, and you stop, you want to see as to whether the system maintains being in compliance with the regulatory standard, or if it's going to revert back to its old self again and bump up above. So for the TCE, it didn't really have much of a steady state. It pretty much flowed right along, and we were able to do our analysis starting with point number 9 and taking it to 17. Or if you say there was a little bit of a steady state in there, because we meet it with the 9 through 16, and we would have met it through 10 through 17. So there was, a couple months where, in that one data free timing, where we didn't meet it. There was a little bit of a lag there. And going back and looking at the vinyl chloride, in retrospect, we pretty much figured that we would go ahead and look at, maybe this is a situation where we were doing M&A, and there wouldn't be, in this particular situation, a steady state lag phase, and that maybe you don't have to take two separate data sets, if you will, 4 for the remediation, 8 for the attainment, that part of the attainment could be backed up into the remediation phase data set because you're just continuing on in an M&A type process. So that's what we went ahead and did. So instead of starting at 9, we went ahead and backed it up 2 data points and started it at data point number 7 and carried it forward to see if we would meet the criteria for attaining and maintaining attainment. So once again, we're going to go back and go through the process again of looking for the outliers to see if there was any in this data set using the Dixon test. And once again, the Dixon outlier test does not show any outliers, either low outliers or high outliers. So with that, we can go ahead and proceed on to the normality test. And the normality test indicates that for the trend analysis in the residuals, it appears normal, so we'll be using a linear regression analysis. And for the all data using the 95 UCL and the mean, it appears normal, so we will then be using the student's TUCL. So for the trend analysis, you can see that our test result is indicative of a decreasing trend. Okay, our test statistic is negative and it's larger than our critical value. And over here on the bottom right, let me bring this up just a little bit here, you can see we have a nice negative trend following through below and maintaining below the regulatory level of 2 parts per billion. So using that criteria, we have met one of the 2 for saying that we've attained our completion. Now we need to see if we can meet the other criteria for the 95 UCL and the mean. And fortunate for us in this particular case, using data point 7 through 16, we have a mean of 1.72 and the 95 UCL on the mean of 1.84, which is less than the cleanup level of 2 parts per billion. So we have met the second criteria as well as the first criteria, and we at this point, you know, make the determination that we are complete and we met our completion criteria for vinyl chloride. So we are good at that point.
Okay, can we unshare the screen? Okay. So Dave's just walked through the remediation phase and attainment phase. We do, if time permits and we can get through all the questions and folks would like to see it, Dave does have some data sets that would show a data set present with an outlier, as well as how we handle detects and a combination of detects and non-detects in a data set. So if anyone has a burning desire to see that, we will try to accommodate you in the time remaining. We have about 15 minutes remaining. We are planning on using that to answer questions and to the extent that we can perhaps demonstrate use with non-detects, or at least we can verbally answer some questions on how non-detects and outliers should be handled. So without further ado, can we get the questions going?
How far back do you want to go with the questions?
Let me see how many we have. Hold on. We got a good amount. Let's just start where we left off.
Or would you rather just keep them to this phase right here?
Or let's start. Yeah, I guess let's start with this question.
Sure. Okay. That'll for you. That'll start like after question 39. If there's a number, it talks about audio breaking up. So I'll start with the first one there, and that is, will you be releasing a non-protected Excel version so we can edit?
As of right now, no. We have always questions about, you know, version control and stuff like that. So as of right now, the tool is as it is. If there are modifications that someone would like to, you know, see in the tool, they can send an email to Kate or I, and we will see about, you know, possibly making some of those modifications. One of the things we tried to keep the tool fairly simple, fairly eloquent and easy to use, and we at one point we thought about putting a lot of stuff in, but it got into you know, application creep. So we try to constrain it to what we have as of right now. But I guess the bottom line is, no, we're not releasing it at this point.
Okay. Seems like you could trigger into attainment monitoring and then trigger back into remediation monitoring later, depending on the data set changes. Is there any benefit of transitioning to attainment since you're going to have to continue sampling until all COCs are below cleanup levels anyway?
So with remediation phase and determining that you're done with remediation, we generally recommend that you do a visual or statistical analysis of all of the contaminant of concern data sets to show that they've all initially reached their cleanup level. That way you're not triggering yourself into attainment at different points for different contaminants. So of course, always when you're in the attainment phase, you can see some rebound that would trigger you back into remediation, some sort of additional monitoring or active treatment. That's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing I'd like to, we tried to show it with the vinyl chloride example that, you know, while it looked like both vinyl chloride and TCE, you know, met the remediation criteria at sampling 0.8, that when you went back and looked at the attainment, you could creep the attainment analysis for vinyl chloride back to 7. So it actually would meet the criteria for attainment earlier than it would for the vinyl, the TCE. So we're not moving back and forth, but it's, you know, some of them might actually start earlier, even though the absolute criteria is, you know, in this particular case, number 8, where they both met it, the limiting factor was that 8 was set due to the TCE and not the vinyl chloride. Hope that helps.
Okay. On your figure, why aren't you using John Wilson's an approach for evaluating the process of a natural attenuation in groundwater document? The U.S. EPA document suggests the concentrations be logarithmic instead of linear to make decisions about trends.
In this particular case, we did not do logarithmic application. We decided that we were limited to a fairly simple system that would use linear normal and non-parametric. So in a case where you have a log type system, you would put that into, it would probably be triggered as a non-normal type calculation, but you could go ahead and do that. If you have M&A in particular as the only thing, you could use John's approach and that would be acceptable.
Okay, this is a couple part question. What do you say about the frequency of sample collecting for 8 samples? Are you concerned about concentration changes with season or with wet years versus drought years? And the third part is, are you looking to show that cleanup levels will not exceed on average over a certain period of time, or that cleanup level will not ever be exceeded at a single point in time?
Okay, for the last one, it's on average. It's not for any single. If you have the 8 data sets, you may have some that exceed, but the 95 UCL on the mean should be below. So it's the average. It's not a single exceedance that would, you know, trigger you out. You can have exceedances, but on average, you don't. Okay, for the first one, we don't speak about the frequency. That is something that should be developed between your site hydrogeologist as to what is the most appropriate frequency for collecting samples. If it is a fine system, you know, maybe it's quarterly or, you know, twice a year. If it is, you know, a course system, maybe you can go as frequently as monthly, but probably not nothing less than that. You just want to make sure that your sampling frequency is representative of the hydrologic conditions at the site, and they match that. With regards to the wet and dry seasons, you know, the general rule of thumb is you take 8 quarterly samples to try and see if you have these kinds of seasonalities or fluctuations. If it goes, you know, much greater than what you could capture in 8 quarterly samples, I think that's pretty tough for any ground system to deal with.
Okay, next question. What if you have multiple plumes from multiple OUs and want to close out a few long before your P core, F core? Is it okay to just do it in the 5 years?
I would document completion of a, if you have multiple plumes at a site that you're addressing with discrete technologies and they're their own definable footprint, I would suggest that you finalize completion of a restoration remedial action for that particular plume in an O&M report, and it can be memorialized in a 5-year review. That information inevitably will need to be put into a site completion document, but I think for purposes, you know, it's the rationale is going to be an operation and maintenance report. The progress of the remedy and the completion can be documented in a 5-year review, yes, and ultimately it will be done in a final closeout report. But for the person that wrote that, you can email me and ask me particular questions on that.
Okay, if you discover an outlier, can it be dropped? Also, is it required to retain 8 consecutive points with no exclusion in between?
With regards to the outliers and can it be dropped, the tool will identify a mathematical outlier. Before you drop it, you have to know and have an understanding as to whether it is truly an outlier or it is an aberration due to sampling, lab QA, QC, or something like that, because the one thing that you want to be able to be sure of is that you're not taking a spike as the plume comes maybe across the monitoring well and calling it an outlier where it truly is an elevated concentration. So while the tool, as I said, gives you the mathematics, you have to have the other logic to identify that it is an outlier and you can eliminate it. Otherwise, you should leave it in.
And then I think in the second part of the question, we talk a little bit in the recommended approach about how to handle duplicate samples. Obviously, we don't want duplicates being handled as 2 separate sampling events, so it needs to be your decision as to whether you take the higher or an average of the two for purposes of your statistical evaluation. But unless you have a documented rationale for excluding a data point, you can't randomly pick what data points you use for purposes of this tool. They need to be consecutive in nature.
Okay. Are there parent-daughter decay considerations that statistical analysis cannot account for?
This particular tool does not consider any daughter product considerations. All the considerations that were developed in the data set were developed by Kate and I. All the data set does is, all the tool does is evaluate the data that you put into it. It is really completely ignorant to whether they're daughter products or not. That has to be an analysis done by a person the hydro, the RPM, you know, your site team with regards to the dollar products.
And we have three questions that all pertain to the same thing, and individuals would like to see how you handle non-detects.
Okay.
All right, can you share?
Sure.
Try to do this real quick. We got a couple minutes. We'll just talk through it. We don't have to run it all. Okay. All right.
All right, so the way the tool handles non-detects is you actually go ahead and put in, you don't put in a value. And in this particular case, you probably wind up just putting the detection limit in. Right? And we're gonna go ahead and pick the last data point as a non-detect. So you identify it as a non-detect, it references it, acknowledges it, in the blue column here is detected or not. All right. And then,
okay.
Yeah. What it does, you still have to walk through the process. So once again, you're going to go ahead and look for outliers. So what the tool will do is, being that you do have a non-detect, it's going to deal with it using the, at least for the UCL, Chebyshev method. Okay? And depending on the normality, it'll either use a linear square or an OLS or the other technique. So what we have is that both the data for the UCL and the trend both appear normal. So with regards to the trend, it's going to use an ordinary least square. Okay. It shows it's decreasing. Okay, and here's the trend line for that and the non-detect. All right, now let me go to the UCL. There's something I want to point out here. It goes through the Kaplan-Meier process for calculating it. All right. Now what we have here is that the non-detect was data point number 18. We had inputted a value of 0.185, which was the upper detection limit. It was a non-detect, and what the program did is use a random number generator, imputed a value somewhere between 0 and point 0.85, and in this particular case, the value that was selected was 0.4. Now, what also happens is that depending on, you know, every time you run it, you couldn't get a different value. Except in the case where, as you notice right here, the random seed used to generate that imputed value is a value of 58738.21875. If you want to duplicate that at a later point, you can go back into the data input at a later time, input that into the screen, and that will regenerate that value of 0.4. If you don't and you let the computer calculate it again, it will develop a new data point somewhere, once again, between, you know, 0 and 0.85. So let me go back to the data endpoint screen, and here you see in this particular cell that seed, if you want to go ahead and duplicate that value for the imputed value for non-detects.
All right, so we can unshare. And I think we've run out of time. So before you guys get the concluding remarks, on behalf of Dave and myself, we'd like to thank you for spending the last 2 hours with us, and I hope you got something out of this. Feel free to call myself or Dave if you have any questions. Shoot us an email. Furthermore, I highly recommend that you fill out the feedback form for us so that we can get some input from you on what was good, bad, mediocre on this presentation, as we're asked to deliver it frequently, so any modifications that you recommend would be helpful. And I'll turn it over to you guys.
Yeah, the only other thing that I'd like to add is, once again, there are some 12 example data sets that are identified also in the user's guide and what they're trying to show. So if you want to exercise the tool and see, you know, what some of its capabilities are, you know, please feel free to go ahead and take those data sets and put them into the tool and run them yourselves, so you can actually can see, you know, non-detects, where the outliers are and things like that. We didn't actually get a chance to do the an outlier example, but you can run the outlier leaving in the outlier, or you have the ability to take out the outlier and run the statistics without that outlier in the data set. So by all means, please go ahead, but if you have any questions, like Kate said, you can get in contact with us and we can help you out a little bit.
Well, thank you, Dave and Kate. So I'm going to go ahead switch over to our closing slides here. As Kate mentioned, we do have, I'm going to walk you through here towards the end, but we do have both a links to additional resources page for this particular seminar, which includes the slides that were presented today, as well as links for the guidance documents and tools. And then the feedback form that Kate mentioned, please fill that out. We're always looking for input on how we can improve our event delivery services and content. On that feedback form, you'll notice that there is a checkbox. You can get an automated feedback confirmation, especially for people that are looking to document their participation in any way. We find that those feedback confirmations are helpful. That'll give you both an email as well as within your browser immediately when you submit the feedback. It'll say that you submitted the feedback at this date and time and your contact information as well, so you can go ahead and just print that out if you need to for documentation purposes. I should also mention that we have a relatively new Cluent participation records feature on the site that will go basically give you a transcript of all the seminars that you registered for and participated in on Cluent. A lot of our participants find that helpful as well for documenting their participation for professional development purposes. And as we mentioned at the beginning, when this event is available in our archives, you will receive an automated email notification letting you know that it's available. You can either view the archives within your browser, or we do offer a couple different download formats, both audio and video, if it's more convenient for you to view them offline. And with that, I'll go ahead and conclude today's seminar. I wanted to thank our presenters once again and thank all of our participants for joining us today. And we hope you found this to be an educational experience and will join us for future events on the Cluent website. Thank you very much.